friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I have a couple of brothers here, and actually they come from near Blaney in County Monaghan. Castle Blaney, to those who are not familiar, indeed, with that particular area of Monaghan. First of all, let me welcome Tony and Brendan Ward, and both of you are very welcome to the program.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks a lot, Adrian.
Of course, we found out about you and the purpose of your visit here through our friend and primary contact in Ireland, who susses out people like yourselves and those who are indeed involved in advocacy. I refer to Mike Hannon from Bonanaden in County Sligo, but both of you actually are here in bringing us up to date, and for some of us, we didn't even know that there was such an organization in Ireland as Fighting Blindness Ireland. And to that end, as is not unusual for Irish families, one brother stayed at home, and the other is in the financial services right here in New York City. And Brendan, I want to start with you because you, among other things, but you're an accomplished musician.
That is an allegation that I deny, but it's true. Back in Ireland when I was living there, I used to play a lot of accordion with some mixed results. So I haven't been playing as much since I got over to New York, but I did actually get into running thanks to Tony's influence over the years, and I probably spend more time out running around Central Park than I do at Irish pubs playing jigs and reels, so I have Tony to thank for my healthy living.
All right, well, let's talk to Tony for a minute. Fighting Blindness Ireland, when was that established?
So, Adrian, it was established in 1983, so we're just over 31 years old now. Established originally by a group of patients of the Eye and Ear Hospital in Dublin who, I guess, found each other. It was pre-Google and all those things, but I guess by just word of mouth, they found each other and discovered that they came from families who had inherited genetic sight loss issues, you know, some of them going back many, many decades and generations. So they initially met, I guess, to act as a support group for each other. It can be very isolating, you know, and frightening, I guess, to be going through a process of losing your sight. So it started off as a support group, and then it quickly moved into trying to find out what on earth was going on in the first place. So very quickly moved into fundraising, actually collaborated with what I would describe as our cousin organization in the United States, Foundation Fighting Blindness, and funded an initial project in Trinity College in Dublin, who actually were the first research project to discover what they then thought was the gene responsible for the condition, what we now know to be one of over 200 genes responsible for the condition. But we had a very leading and prime role in the whole beginning of the search to try and find out you know, what was at the root of these sight loss issues.
I think probably the first question that comes to mind would be, okay, where does the gene come from? Is it peculiar to families? How does the gene show up? Is there a telltale? Is there some telltale sign that would make, for instance, both of you you know, more likely to get this disease.
Mm. Well, I guess I come from an accounting background, not a scientific one, but I'll answer that mm-hmm. the best I can. And in quite lay terms, there are two prevalences of inheritance of conditions that cause blindness. One is dominant. So, you know, there's lots of examples in mm-hmm. family generations of it happening. So I guess in terms of telltale signs, I think was the word you used.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, they would be on high alert for their children, you know, inheriting the condition. And some is passed down from mothers to sons. So clearly the male children are more at risk, and then others are more, you know, it's more a 50-50 chance mm-hmm. Regardless of the gender of the children. But in the case of myself and Brendan, we are more in a recessive form of inheritance. So there was no history at all going back in our family of blindness. I guess I have to now declare I'm 13 years older than Brendan. Mm-hmm. You can probably tell by his youthful voice. But so
I don't know, you sound the same to me.
Okay, well, yeah. We should probably say this is Tony speaking, by the way, for the benefit of everyone.
I do have a lot to add after Tony's finished.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't finished.
But I guess I was first down the tracks, and in my own case, again, thinking of telltale signs, they were small telltale signs, like definitely in the dark. And that is often actually a feature of people who have a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which is RP for short, but definitely not being able to see well in the dark is a bit of a telltale sign. And then other people would have things like, say, depth perception issues. So one of my colleagues talks about, you know, falling up or down steps, you know, so definitely little telltale signs, a lot of which, you know, I guess you almost cover up in a way, especially when you're younger. But then, yeah, from a clinical point of view, if it gets to a certain point and you go for a proper diagnosis, yeah, I guess from a scientific point of view, they can actually see what's going on in the back of your eye.
Does, when, in your case, did the blindness begin at what age?
I was 25, yeah. So between 25 and 28, I had a major sort of dip in my sight, you know. And I guess with all these conditions, just to give you a couple of figures, and again, this would be quite consistent around the world in terms of, you know, it's not something that would affect the Irish population more than any other developed country. But there are... you know, in excess of about 220,000 people in Ireland affected by different types of blindness. And this is not just inherited conditions, but all sorts of conditions that cause blindness. And those figures would be sort of replicated in other countries. Like a similar figure I've seen in the United States is like 10 million people, which would be a similar percentage. But yeah, it's often the case with a lot of those people of losing sight, not, you know, one day you could see, the next day you can't. It's often the case of something that's happening over a long number of years. So I was 25, I was diagnosed when I was 28. I'm 48 now, and I still have some peripheral vision. So it's not just a dark world, but it's a world that's very, you know, it's hard to describe. I would sometimes describe it like, if people remember milk bottles, mm-hmm. it might be like looking through four layers of milk bottles last, so you know there's something on the other side, but you don't know what it is.
More like shadows.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, but with some detail, but not very useful detail. You know, often distorted detail.
Now you were as a chartered accountant in Ireland. Your career was well underway before you discovered any of this, was it?
Yeah, I'd qualified in the late 1980s, so I guess I was 2 or 3 years qualified at this point. So, I mean, back in those days, it's actually amazing the progress that technology has made, because now I work quite happily with my computer and my adaptive software and all those things. But back then, the most sophisticated piece of equipment we had was a calculator, you know, and a pen and a bottle of Tippex, you know. So I'll tell you, I went through a phase of losing my sight where there was more Tippex on the page than there was biro, you know. But, you know, that was, it was challenging anyway, but it was definitely challenging from a work point of view, you know, given all the detail of those numbers and everything.
We want to talk to the Yank here. Brendan, the younger brother, what brought you to the United States?
The real answer is Tony threw me out because of, you know, a succession of bad manners and complaints. But
sibling rivalry and...
exactly.
Older brothers are like that. Tell me about it.
Well, no. I went to... after I finished in UCD doing commerce and French, I went to London to work. A job came up and I went for it, and it was a good experience to live somewhere different. And obviously the Irish community in London is renowned and large, and the music obviously suited me as well over there. And then I got a transfer with work across to the New York office. So I worked in financial services. An opportunity came up and I thought, why not? So that's what brings me here. I've been here about 3.5 years now.
Now, when in your life did you find that perhaps, was this after Tony's experience there?
It's probably a very similar. We've had similar journeys, I suppose, because in my mid-20s as well, I had a similar set of tests done and similar predictions around, well, there might be something to watch out for. So as Tony said earlier, there are telltale signs, like if you've got someone else in the family, it's important to get checked out. So at least you know what might be around the corner. So that's very much what was my situation. There's difference in predictions depending who you go to, right? Different experts will have different prophecies of what might happen. So in my case, the progression was probably less severe, but it did mean that I started to have challenges with using the computer at work, for example. Mm-hmm. And similar to Tony, although the Tippex was more or less gone by the time I arrived, I was still having challenges day to day. So I think to echo a point Tony made.
Of course, we all have spell check now. So that's
exactly, so there's no excuses. But I think technology is a huge enabler. So when we think now of all the times for you to have difficulty with your eyesight, this era is probably the best, if you'll excuse the optimism there, because we do have a huge array of technology, which is now mainstream, thanks to some of the producers of mobile phones that I won't name. So I don't want to give anyone a plug, but there's lots of devices there that are readily available, mainstream, in the shops that you can use with voice-over technology, with all that kind of stuff. So when it comes to handling these challenges, whether it's software on your computer or your mobile phone, it's readily available, it's not unusual, and it's great from Tony and my perspective to see this as a normal part of day-to-day living.
Tony, as a chartered accountant, and you work in Dublin primarily, yes?
Yeah, so I've done a bit of a very naughty career shift in the last couple of years. So having been involved in fighting blindness since I was diagnosed 20 years ago, and, you know, I was on the board of directors for a number of years, and I did various fundraising challenges and marathons and various things, I actually... left my chartered accountancy behind, thankfully. You can cut that out later. I moved into a position of head of fundraising with Fighting Blindness 2 years ago. So it's something, you know, I didn't plan or predict in any way. It's something that just came as a number of coincidental conversations. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it, you know, it's good.
Tell us about your organization, Fighting Blindness Ireland.
So as I said earlier, what we've primarily been doing over the years is funding research, and so many good things have come out of that increasingly actually over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, I guess. So, you know, there have been a number of breakthroughs. We fund research in like Trinity College, University College Dublin, Waterford Institute of Technology, UCC in Cork, Galway, In fact, Queen's University Belfast as well, we have a project now starting, which is a collaboration between the North and the Republic of Ireland, yeah. Because, you know, from a genetic perspective, I guess it's a 32-county issue that needs to be solved. So we've funded research. We also provide counselling, which is a really important part of what we do, because often how people come onto our radar is that they go into the ophthalmologist, having had some, to use your words again, some telltale sign of something happening. They get a diagnosis for which there is no cure at the moment, and it's devastating, you know. So we actually provide a counselling service, and in fact, our counselling psychotherapist goes to those hospitals on those days so they can be a sort of a safety net in some way for people coming out. So that is really important, and we're involved in a range of information provision, advocacy and empowerment type services. So, you know, our role has changed a lot over the years as things advance. They move into, I guess our dream is that things move from academic research into commercial production, because that's where treatments and cures are going to come from. But, you know, there's always plenty to do, you know, as that happens.
Let me ask you about the, do most ophthalmologists, do they know instantly, is the diagnosis something that is very evident?
I don't know, is the very honest answer to your question. I guess in some instances, my understanding is that if an ophthalmologist looks into your eye and there's some of this retinal degeneration going on, that it is quite obvious. But there are so many different conditions, even within that one umbrella of retinitis pigmentosa, it can be hard to diagnose it accurately. And I guess, too, often a problem, or it's not a problem, it's just reality, that, as was my experience, and indeed Brendan's and thousands of other people, you're trying to survive, you know, in the world. So you have a job, you have a family, you know, you might be driving a car, you're doing whatever you're doing, and, you know, you're not avoiding the truth, but I guess in many cases you're clinging on by your fingertips, and, you know, in that way, often diagnoses come quite late, you know, in a process.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I was speaking to a guy 2 weeks ago who has a history of a condition called age-related macular degeneration, which is a very common form of retinal degeneration in older people. And he has a family history of his grandmother, his father, his sister have it. But he hasn't gone to the ophthalmologist because, you know, in a way he's afraid to find out. He's just not ready to find out what he might find out, you know. So that's the challenge all over the issue.
Brendan, I want to ask you about the oncoming disease.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a slow process? Is it the same with both members, say, of your family,
mm-hmm.
From the onset to the diagnosis? Is
mm-hmm.
that a short period? Does it happen quickly?
It can go on for a long time. I think what Tony said was very accurate, because it just depends on each person's scenario, right? We're all different, and this degeneration you can't predict, nor can you blame anyone for it. That's kind of one of the big hurdles at the start of the process is when you start to feel that you're having difficulty with day-to-day tasks, or the computer screen is a bit too hard to see, or you get into struggle mode quite soon, because that's our human nature, just kind of press on and do the best we can. And we're also slow to ask for help.
Yeah.
And slow to call it something in case we have now a label, and none of us want labels. And I think the message from Fighting Blindness, not just in terms of fundraising all the great research in Ireland, is also one of let's not accept the blindness, let's not tolerate the blindness, let's not ignore the blindness, let's fight the blindness, meaning we fight it with facts. You know, we go to the consultants, we try and seek out the help so that people can diagnose. So that's pushing yourself to get a diagnosis is tough, but it's the best first step. And then you've got facts on the table, and there's a lot of support groups out there. Some of the ones Tony had mentioned earlier, like how Fighting Blindness came about in the first place, was a support group. So tapping into that vast network of support groups helps you figure out, well, what does this mean for me? And the ideal scenario, which is, life's not an ideal scenario, but the ideal is really get the facts, get the help. There's no one at fault here. We can't blame ourselves for having dodgy eyes. It's just the way life pans out. And connecting with that support network and connecting with Fighting Blindness and the U.S. Foundation Fighting Blindness, having those connections is really key. You might want to fundraise for them. You might want to get information from them. You know, at least having that connection means you're not isolated and trying to figure out things like this on your own.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that within our listening audience, there are many who either have family members or friends, acquaintances of younger people. Somehow it's much easier to accept all of this as part of the aging process. But younger people, and I suppose you wouldn't blame any of us from thinking that that both of you brothers have decided to continue life as it was and not look for an alternative. Tony, you as a marathoner, traveling Europe and again, being able to function in what it is you do best. Somewhere along the way, was there a part of you that says, I better look for an alternative career here?
And thank you for mentioning my marathons, by the way. I'd like to point out at this stage that not only is Brendan younger than me, possibly more good looking, I don't know, I can't see him, but he's also a faster runner than me as well. So clearly cyclops is not the only genetic thing we have in common.
But he's getting up there. I mean, 13 years is nothing. Let's face it.
We also have huge appetites.
Yeah, that's right. My wife says that Brendan is the only person she knows in the world who can eat more than I can, you know, so that may be another genetic thing we have in common.
I might ask either of you where you put it, but anyway, that's right.
We do a lot of running. We do a lot of running.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of alternatives, I do feel quite lucky, and you know, not understating it now. The last 25 odd years of my life has been very, very challenging because, you know, as I said earlier, it's not a question of losing your sight in one day. It's like adapting hundreds and hundreds of times as things slide, you know, down a scale. You know, so to go from having peripheral vision to using a cane at night, to using a cane in the daytime, to using a cane all the time, to, you know, you're just going through these constant iterations of adapting to daily life, and each one is a, you know, requires mental strength to press on to the next stage.
Right.
But in terms of alternatives, like I do feel quite fortunate that having sort of having just toughened up, I guess, when times were difficult, and I had the capacity to do that. You know, then, as Brendan said earlier, other things came online, like adaptive software and accessible mobile phones and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and you suddenly realize, I don't want to be too presumptuous about it, but like 30, 40 years ago, if you were blind, you basically were a telephonist, a basket weaver, or unemployed, you know, and
right.
that was pretty much it. Whereas now there are many, many things that people can do through software, and you know, that is super. So I think I was lucky in the mid-90s that stuff was starting to come on stream. And, okay, I had, you know, various hiatuses in my careers, and I certainly didn't progress along my accounting to see career like other people did. But still, you know, I didn't fall off the scale, and, you know, it was, there always seemed the next obvious step. You know, so that was good.
in the beginning, and again, we should acknowledge that the breakthrough coming from Trinity College in Dublin is tremendous, and we should, you know, give Trinity credit where credit is due there. But initially, it was considered to be a gene, an isolated gene without too much information other than what about your father and mother? Mm. How were they, to what level of acceptance did they have with respect to say, okay, well, one of you or both of you are carriers of that gene, and what is the human response to that, and saying, well, wait a minute, that's not my side of the family, because...
Well, we were asked the questions about our parents and where they related, and obviously being Irish and living on either side of the same lake, we obviously said not at all, but I think when you think about blindness or anything else, our parents bring us up and they try to equip us with the strongest set of cards to play and succeed in the game of life. And when something comes along like blindness or disability of any kind or all sorts of other challenges in life, someone just wrenches some of your top cards off you and gives you what might be perceived as duds. So you suddenly have a new set of cards. When parents see that happen, like in our case, they're not jumping for joy, right? Clearly they're concerned. They're worried about our chances and all the rest of it. But does it mean to say you can't still maneuver yourself into winning the game? I mean, I'm not a card player, so I've got, it's not a good analogy. But I think in the end, it comes down to, can you maneuver your way around a change of cards and come up with a winning game? That's really the end result. And Tony and I have been very lucky with Mum and Dad. They've been very supportive. I think in Ireland, we're very lucky to have, as Irish people, an equality around things like this. In the end, everyone's equal. Everyone's got their struggle with whatever it might be. And being able to talk about it with people, I think, at home is great. And obviously the stigmas in the past, and obviously not everyone's the same in acceptance, but we've been lucky and we're keen to make sure that folks feel, whether it's at home or with friends or at work or wherever they can find the support, go and get it, because you deserve it, right? You deserve to reach out and get help and support to navigate these choppy waters, and you get through it because the technology is there, the research is there, and then you've got Fighting Blindness and organizations of this caliber that are really there to help push forward the progress.
What about siblings? Now, you're two in a family of five?
Yeah, that's right.
Who, in what order? Are you the...
I'm the eldest.
Eldest, right? Yeah.
And boldest.
Yes. It's my duty. And I also stand... I'm currently in negotiating with my parents for 100% inheritance of their fortunes.
You're absolutely right.
Sorry,
after a crack, after a crack like that, absolutely. You have two sisters?
Two sisters and one brother.
And one brother.
Yeah.
And... Brendan, you're the youngest?
I'm joint youngest, so one of those sisters is my twin, Maria, and she would kill me if I didn't mention her by name. So they, none of our three siblings have perfect eyesight.
You better mention the other sister.
Julianne
and Kieran is her brother.
And Kieran.
So Tony and I are the black sheep of the family from an eyesight standpoint.
Yes.
And every other respect, we're the...
We're also the black sheep.
How many of them run from one end of Europe to the other, and not to mention...
I think between them they could keep up with us.
You come from an athletic family? I mean,
well, Daddy had us chasing cattle on the roads of Monaghan from a very early age, so if you can out-sprint a bullock on the roads in Monaghan, the chances of you winning a 100-metre race are quite quite high.
What's the name of the village? I know you said it's you're near...
Lochagish,
Lochagish. And how close is that to Castlevania?
It's about 6 miles. We're sort of equidistant from, say, Carrickmacross and Castlevania, so it's quite mid-Monaghan. And for any of your listeners who, you know, may have remember Ireland sort of pre-1980s. Loch Eagers was very well known for its creamery butter at the time.
Absolutely.
And it's a stunning part of the country. So I know there's a lot of eager tourists going to Monaghan every year, so just book early to avoid disappointment.
Are you sure that were you part of the Gathering Ireland last year, 2013? I mean, you're coming on here with commercials.
Yeah. I was listening to it on the radio, but I didn't participate. So no, I'm not getting a cut.
Your siblings, are they considered to be any more likely to get the disease? Mm. Is it most likely the male?
We don't know is the short answer. You know, so this is the.
Is there a pattern at all?
You know, there in the types of varieties of retinal degenerative conditions with those 200 plus genes that you mentioned is so varied that there are probably hundreds of patterns of inheritance. So because for a couple of reasons, because myself and Brendan were the first in our family tree to have this condition, we don't know. Until recently, it was the ability to have people genetically profiled, you know, to give them their exact genetic diagnosis, was not really possible because it was so expensive. I mean, I think the first time that anyone in the world got a genetic a full genome, as they call it, diagnosis, you know, it cost like $10 million or something, you know. It was so now it's coming down and now it's more affordable. Now you're talking about maybe $1,000 to $1,500 per person. So now is actually the time when, you know, people are going to be getting genetic diagnosis. And that's important because now is also the time when there is the potential for treatments coming down the line. So until you know what your exact diagnosis is, well, you know, you don't know whether the treatment is suitable for you or not. So,
right.
So to answer your question about our siblings and so on, I don't know. There's clearly some inheritance pattern in our family because the two of us have it. So whether that's that girls carry it, you know, and pass it on to male children, or I suspect in our family, because it's recessive, it would only manifest itself if, you know, somebody had a kid with a partner who also was a carrier, you know, of the gene. So we're probably less likely to have it passed on through generations of our
family.
Now,
you have two children, Tony. Girls?
Yeah, two girls, 7 and 5.
7 and 5.
Mm.
And there's no... they're hale and hearty and there's no reason to believe, particularly, you know, because of your own siblings, that they're in any more danger than anybody else.
I don't think so. There's certainly no evidence so far that they can't... they can see perfectly well, thank God. But, you know, and it's another consideration, I guess, and it's a very personal decision, but I know myself and my wife, Eleanor, and I guess I better mention my two girls as well. Molly is 7 and Rachel's 5. But, you know, when we were planning to have a family, we sort of said that, you know, we're set up to deal with blindness in our family. You know, like, so, you know, it's not going to catch us by surprise, and it wasn't for us anything that we said we wouldn't have kids just in case. You know, we felt that, you know, if the bad luck was in it, and we didn't delve any more than that, but if there was some sort of inheritance pattern that we were unaware of, you know, we were still willing to take the chance on it, you know. So, but so far, there's no evidence that they do have the condition.
Brendan, are you free and easy, loose and running, or do you have your family too?
No, I'm trying to behave myself over here. My partner Joe's here, keeping an eye on me, so that helps me. And I guess it is a good question to ask because it does come up a lot around families and how many others in the family and all the rest of it.
Right.
So as Tony says, thank God we have a big Irish family because you kind of got that support network with all the brothers and sisters and cousins. So we're very lucky to have that.
Yeah.
From an organization that started off with just a couple of people, you are now, and this is this sounds amazing, that without you know, much help from the government or from health boards, that your organization has now what, 13 or so in staff?
Yeah, 13. Yeah.
And so to that end, how closely do you work with Foundation Fighting Blindness in the United States?
We're not related from a governance point of view. Like they have their own structures, we have our structures, but we work very closely with them. In fact, my colleague, our CEO, Avril Daly, was telling some people this week that last year their chief scientific officer visited us in Ireland, and he was telling us about their new strategy, you know, for the next 5 years, and with absolutely no cross-fertilization of us influencing their strategy. It was exactly the same one as we were trying to roll out in Ireland, you know. So, I mean, I think for a long time there's been drivers behind both Foundation Fighting Blindness in the US and drivers with a similar mindset between Fighting Blindness Ireland. And there's been a lot of collaboration. Like, we have people on our medical scientific advisory board in Ireland who are specialists and researchers in the United States. They have co-funded, like, that project in Trinity College I mentioned to you. It's likely in the near future we'll be sending some people over to one of the leading research facilities in Wisconsin to learn from the progress that they've been making and bring it back to a project in Galway. So there's been a huge amount of just natural, and I guess in the 21st century, necessary collaboration, because you know, you don't want to be putting money into something that somebody somewhere else in the world has already done or figured out.
Right.
So I think collaboration is absolutely vital, and it's been very healthy toing and froing.
And successful,
between. Yeah.
What kind of budget are you working on?
So, I mean, our annual budget at the moment is about $2.5 million, which is quite significant in proportionate terms, given that we're a population of 4 million people. Versus the United States, 320 million. You know, it's quite a significant amount to raise. So yeah, that's, you know, it's ebbed and flowed over the years. Obviously, with the economic recession in Ireland over the last 5 or 6 years, you know, there's been a lot of pressure on that. And yeah, we would aim to invest approximately half of that into research, other amounts of it into our support through our counselling services and through our advocacy, and then, you know, obviously supporting the running of our office and so on.
Right.
Yeah, it's about a $2.5 million budget.
Now, this is not, you didn't capture and snare this into your native Monaghan. As a matter of fact, you have, throughout, as you had mentioned, throughout the 32 counties in Ireland, there's not only awareness, but you're also getting response.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was a very interesting. I mean, things are moving so fast. It's a problem, but it's a super problem to have, because, you know, we've dreamed, and you know, it was a Gary Player or somebody, the golfer, who said, you know, the more often I practice, the luckier I get. You know, it's a little bit like that. You know, the harder you push, the more things happen, and the bigger your challenges become. But they're really the ones you want. But recently, we have also had various collaborations over the years with Northern Ireland, and recently we are now co-funding a project in Queen's University in Belfast, and you know, we're now going to collaborate with them on building the register of genetic profile of people affected by these conditions. So that's going to be an all-Ireland project, which again is it makes absolutely perfect sense from a genealogy perspective, and you know, it's the right thing to do, you know. So
For both of you this week, your schedule is fairly hectic, but considering who has been sussing out this trip for you, that's not a
no
That's not too much of a surprise. Among other groups, you have visited among many organizations here. The Irish Business Organization, IBO, organized a meeting for you. Let me ask you about the reaction that you are getting here, and how familiar, if at all, are most of the people that you are that you're meeting here in order to at least start the process of getting support?
Tony here, vice-wise. You're right. Mike has set us a very active schedule over the last few days, but again, that's fantastic because we've come over here exactly to try and do that. I mean, it's the first time we've done something like this. We've had a lot of meetings. I personally think we've had a fantastic response. It's really interesting how, I guess, people, there's a sense of people very much empathizing with the size of the population who are affected by sight loss. And I think also a sense of learning that it's not, you're either blind or you're not. I think there's a real sense of people getting the idea that it's people struggling with the loss of sight over an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. So I really get that. I'm also really actually surprised by the number of people we've met who, have a cousin, have a niece, friend who has a son or a daughter, or even people themselves who come along to our meetings who have connections with sight loss. And, I think that's really positive. Obviously, it's you're always, it's not nice to hear that somebody is going through their own struggle, but from our organizational it's very positive to just get a snapshot of how this is affecting people, real people around the place, not only in Ireland but in the United States. And
the staggering figure I would have to say is that 250,000 people in Ireland are affected by some degree of sight loss. That seems to be very high, but
it is very high, and we sort of, it's been, that figure has come from research, so it's not plucked out of the sky. And
right.
There are similar figures from other countries, and we always sort of pinch ourselves too to believe are we putting this figure out there and it's not accurate, but I think it is, and I think it's a big health issue, but because in the past, as I mentioned earlier, in a lot of cases, people didn't have, there was no solution to the sight loss. They weren't a pressing medical need, so they didn't have to stay under their doctor's supervision. And they just went home, and got on with losing their sight type of thing. But now that...
This sounds terrible because it sounds almost like a pun, but is there a stigma attached to this particular disease in pretty much in terms of saying, as you have said, Tony, yourself, the ophthalmologist today, as in 30 years ago, would say, this is what you have, and there really isn't any cure for it. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense, say, within families or those to say, this is a hopeless case, it's horrific that it happens, but despite the research and all the modern technology and all the rest of it, the affliction has got to be one of enormous effect
mm-hmm.
on a family.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is. It's huge, and Brendan mentioned it earlier, but, in relation to you asked about our own mum and dad, I know that, even though they've been absolutely super, I know that they feel really bad about it, because it's a genetic thing. It's clearly something they pass on to us, and there's nothing they can do anything about, So it's something that, it weighs on them,
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely does, and, it weighs on families. Something else you touched on earlier, which I hope is going to change, is that, you know, sometimes people don't talk about these things. You know, it's just you know,
and we're particularly
as
a race, as a nation, we're particularly good at not talking about about afflictions. And as a matter of fact, over many things that have over the generations left us somewhat vulnerable to.
It is a strange anomaly, because on the one hand we're great talkers in Ireland and we love talking with each other, and there's no one a stranger, and yet when it comes to disability it is kind of tricky, because you've got visible disabilities and invisible disabilities and they're both hard to deal with. I think in the end
this is by no means an isolated one either. You know,
I don't think there's any particular stigma, Tony, would you say, to macular degeneration per se, but it's more the general awareness issue that in Ireland is a big focus for all of the organisations like Fighting Blindness Ireland. Awareness is key, because you can't do anything without awareness, and obviously acceptance comes next, but awareness is the starting point. And I think awareness means people know there's something there that needs attention, something that needs support, and something that needs progress.
That's right. And like, you know, you're absolutely, I think it's the type of thing perhaps people didn't talk about. I know people would feel awkward around me, say back in my local community. It's slightly I guess you change the rules yourself as you go along, but you know, few people, and I'm very open about it, as you can tell, but you know, few people would, even that I knew and I played football with when I was a kid and everything, you know, they wouldn't say, you know, they sort of almost rather just avoid you. I don't mean that in a bad way, but rather than have to, what are they going to say to you? Like, you know, so there has been that very, stigma, I guess, about it. But I suppose now, and we're actually seeing this through our counselling service very recently, there is actually a reason to talk about it now, because, well, two points of view. First of all, you know, there is progress, and there are treatments, and in fact people should forget about inherited genetic conditions like myself and Brendan, but just for general eye health, and it's something that Fighting Blindness is involved in, you know, people need to go visit their optometrist, and they need to get their eyes checked, and lots of conditions can be prevented or caught at an early stage. So, you know, I think people's sort of, if you go back to O'Carroll and the blind musician, like I think people are moving away from, you know, you're either blind or you're not, to more of a sense of it's so important to look after your eyes, and it's so important to, you know, be able to improve it or retain it.
Since the founding of the organization, $20 million dollars has been raised primarily in Ireland to go into research, and across our side of the pond, as far as I know, nobody has actually come here. I think it is terrific that you're here. It's also, I would say, for many people here who don't make a topic of conversation about a relative or a friend who has a disease that there is no cure for even today, it would not, maybe this is a good time to take the message and to say, yes, there is an organization in Ireland. There's also an organization here. The organization in Ireland, fightingblindness.ie,
www.fightingblindness.ie.
Okay, and you're located, by the way, at 7 Ely Place in Dublin, Ireland.
Just off Stephen's Green, for anyone who's familiar with that area of the city.
Thank you for being with us. I think we get a much better understanding of it. And I want to end on a note, though, and tell you, Brendan, that as with O'Carolan, you know, there are high expectations in the music field and in the appreciation field. I think maybe less running, more melodian,
I just need to stay away from the Guinness, Adrian.
can I just, Brendan, I think, modestly did himself a disservice. He actually is a participated in the FLA in Ireland many times on the piano accordion and the concertina as well, did you?
Really?
Yeah, he did. He's being modest.
Don't encourage anyone to go and look at the records, Tony.
Yeah, yeah. No,
I prefer my running records.
Yeah, this actually is the first year, due to other pressures we had here, that we have not broadcast and been to the FLA in Ireland. And, you know, from Cavan to Sligo,
we're hoping it goes back to Mayo soon, Adrian.
Absolutely. Well, it's getting closer.
Yeah, it's circling us.
Okay. The Ward Brothers, Tony and Brendan, the organization Fighting Blindness Ireland, www.fightingblindness.ie. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.